It's time for another episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur.
The automobile company, right. Or the dealerships.
Right, the dealerships. The
dealerships, for example, they give away a lot of items.
Right.
So we're like, okay, you've got this big poster in the window. It's made in USA. And then someone comes and you give them a product, and inside the product it says made in China.
Right.
What kind of message is that sending? You're not standing behind what you believe in. And it was a much easier sell when the premium for made in USA was much smaller.
Right.
So that really opened our market up. And thank God that was already 12 years ago.
Yeah.
But for the last 10 years, we've had a much bigger market, and unions have become a much smaller part of our customer base. Now it's just as much, probably as much as anything, corporations. We do a lot of military contracts now.
Right.
This year, up until the time of coronavirus hit, we were almost 100% political campaign.
Sure. They're all buying from you. I saw that LinkedIn thing you posted. Yeah.
So, we really were able to broaden who we were selling to and the types and number of products that we were selling.
And now the information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hi, this is Mitch Kahn. I'm the president of Unionwear. We manufacture hats, bags, portfolios, and binders, all made in the USA in Newark, New Jersey, for the promotional market, the military, and the fashion industry.
All right, Mitch. So thanks for coming on the podcast. I know with how busy you are, it's been before this whole pandemic, crazy busy, all kinds of stuff. You always got things going on. And we'll talk about what's going on in your factory. Hopefully when this thing comes out, things will calm down by then. But for now, we're all locked up in our houses and everything. But you and I know each other a long time. Actually, our parents know each other before we were born. Maybe you want to go back and talk about, you know, where you grew up and where you went to school and your training, your background, and how you kind of got into the business and the company that you're in now.
Sure. So I grew up in Roseland, New Jersey, right outside of Newark. For high school, we moved out to Mendham, New Jersey, a little further out there. And then I ended up at the University of Pennsylvania studying finance at the Wharton School. Got a job in investment banking at a 2-year analyst program at Bear Stearns. And I did not like it. I had spent my whole life preparing for that job. And I realized I do not want to work in finance. I don't want to be a professional. I want to run a business. I want to be a small businessman. I want to make stuff. So at the end of that 2-year program, I did not look for another job in finance. I drove around the country picking up ideas to start, ended up with an opportunity to buy a bankrupt baseball hat factory, not really buy the company, but actually buy the assets that were foreclosed on by the bank at an auction sale.
Right.
And in the time between finding out about this opportunity and executing the auction sale, I came up with a business plan for this business, which was to manufacture baseball caps for the fashion industry, which was not a thing at the time. This was 1992.
Right.
And in 1992, before 1991, baseball hats were really a sporting good. You could go buy a Yankee hat at a sporting goods store.
Right.
You could get, occasionally you could find a college hat.
They were but they were all team related.
They were team related.
Right.
There was no fashion baseball hat. Around 1991, baseball hats became more of a fashion accessory in the streetwear market. So some of the most popular hats at that time were the pot leaf hat that Snoop Dogg wore in a lot of his videos.
Right.
There was a Batman movie came out. There was the Bat logo on the front of a hat. Malcolm X came out. A lot of people wearing hats with an X on it.
Right.
A lot of skateboard companies like Stussy started to sell hats with their logos on it. And this was just as I was about to start this company. I thought, you know what? What's not happening yet is Ralph Lauren's not selling hats.
Right.
The Gap's not selling hats. There's got to be a market for this.
Oh, they weren't. At that time, in those days, Mitch, you couldn't get like you can get it, you know, whatever, different stores where you can get their logo. You couldn't get that stuff in those days?
No, they weren't selling baseball hats yet. Huh. Most fashion stores weren't selling baseball hats yet.
Right.
If you wanted a hat, you would go to Herman's Sporting Goods.
Right. I remember Herman's. They're out of business and they got bought or something.
Yeah, they went out of business. Right. So also there was no made in China yet. There's really not a lot of made in Mexico yet. Everything was still pretty much made in USA.
Well, remember 92, the internet was just coming out. I remember I was in an Israel trip. That wasn't the trip I think we were on together, but and there was like a conference in Israel with kids from Europe and the United States and Israel, and they were talking about this thing called the internet. I'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
And it was 92.
So it was a very different time. There was no internet. I started the factory and I pounded the pavement in New York and met with a lot of fashion companies and had a lot of success very early on. We got a huge order from Ralph Lauren. We did business with Izod and Gant and Nordstrom and Neiman Marcus. And it was a very easy sell because baseball hats were just becoming popular. And my pitch to them was, listen, you probably are sitting on fabrics that you bought that you're not using. Send me the fabrics. I'll turn them into baseball hats. And what sweetened the pot was at the time, there were outlet stores were just becoming popular.
Right. Like the one upstate? There's a big yes. Ralph Lauren outlet there.
Yes. Right. Up in Harriman, Woodbury Commons.
Right. Woodbury Commons. Right.
So I don't remember exactly when they started sprouting up all over the place, but before then there was really just, there was a place in Long Island, there was Secaucus.
Right.
That was really about.
Then right, and a lot of the outlets really were just secondary leftover merchandise. They weren't like they are today.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then brands started investing in outlet stores as a place to sell their own merchandise without having to rely on the department stores.
Right.
And they need merchandise to sell that wasn't competitive with the department stores because they didn't want to bite the hand that fed them.
Makes sense.
So that's where we did a lot of our business. We said, hey, this is a great product for your outlet stores. You're not selling hats yet. Why don't you put these in your outlet stores?
And this came from you pounding the pavement, knocking on doors, and making connections?
That's it.
All
networking. I had no experience in fashion. Right. I had no experience in hats.
No, but you've always been a good networker. You've always been a good networker making contacts. I mean, that's what it's about, no matter what you're selling.
So
yeah,
we were able to sell that, and that went pretty well for a couple of years. And then two years into it, 1994, one by one, all of our fashion customers started moving overseas to South Korea, really is where a lot of the headwear companies went to, later on China.
Okay.
So we lost a lot of business really quickly, and that's when we came up with the idea of, hey, you know what? Let's start our own line of hats, and came up with this novel idea. Let's make hats out of hemp.
Right, hemp cotton.
Yes, hemp. Right. Well, it was actually hemp. There's no cotton in it. It was 100% hemp.
Hemp, so it was hemp is a leaf. I mean, what is hemp?
So hemp is the cannabis plant.
Okay.
And hemp fabric is made from the fibers from the stalk of the cannabis plant.
Okay.
It was really a novel thing at the time. It was a novelty. We sold it as a novelty.
Right.
It carried us through the 90s. I remember we went to Woodstock 94 and had a retail booth. And I think we sold like in 24 hours, we sold about 2,500 hats. Right. They were everywhere. We thought, wow, we really have something. And then we started selling them to stores. We did a lot of custom work for bands and products like Ben & Jerry's and Aveda and Body Shop. And that carried us through the end of the 90s. And then it really started to peter off. Hemp didn't resurface again for about 20 years. And then around 1998, we said, you know, when we started this business, every hat was made in America. Now they're dropping like flies. There was probably 1,000 hat factories in the country in the 80s. And I think at that point, it was down to a few dozen that were left. So the overseas really wiped out the headwear industry.
Right.
So we started pushing ourselves as made in USA, and we completely pivoted the company to selling made in USA products. But in particular, we were the only union shop left. So we said, let's promote ourselves to unions themselves who are looking for union made products for the items that they give away,
right,
or for, to their membership.
Right, their membership. Got it.
And that's when we started Unionwear. So we changed the name to Unionwear.
Got it.
When we were in the hemp business, we were Headcase Hemp Hats.
Right.
And so we started making baseball hats, to selling them to unions. That went very well. A few years later, we got into some other products, mainly bags, backpacks, laundry bags,
right,
messenger bags, attaches, etc.
Now, who are you making those for? I know you did some military contracts, but they were also for retail companies? I mean, from a whole
From 98 until about 2010,
okay,
there was no retail to be had. Retail was 100% buying overseas. It was just so much less expensive.
Right.
To get products made overseas until the recession hit and China's economy started booming and the premium paid for made in USA merchandise started to shrink.
Got it. Okay.
So, but 98 to around, for 98, 99, we were the hemp business was tailing off and we were selling hats to labor unions. That was the entire business.
Right.
2000 rolls around and we get a shot in the arm because the internet has really started to come into its own. E-commerce becomes a viable way to transact goods.
Right.
And the John Kerry campaign, no, I'm sorry, I made a mistake there. The Al Gore campaign, the Al Gore campaign wanted to make baseball hats a primary component of their fundraising strategy. So any small donation, I think it was like $25, they would send them a baseball hat. They wanted it to be union made in America. We right. were like the only place they could get this from. So they contact us and we end up with a tremendous order for the Gore Lieberman campaign, which carried us
not just
through November, but until I think February or March of the following year.
So they found you because you were one of the few left shops in America, or?
Yeah, we were really the only place that could do what they wanted to do, which right. was a union made in USA embroidered baseball hat.
And they put what, their slogan on it or something?
Gore Lieberman.
Yeah, oh, it's just Gore Lieberman. Okay.
Did hundreds of thousands of hats.
Their logo.
For them. And then, so that was a new market for us, was political campaigns in the
right.
early 2000s. Our union business grew because we had a higher profile then. And then 2004 rolls around,
right.
and we have the John Kerry campaign. We're still really just making hats for political campaigns and unions at that point. But then something interesting happened. New Jersey raised its minimum wage much higher than the rest of the country. And okay. it was kind of a wake-up call for us because we weren't paying minimum wage to our workers. We were a union shop, but we also weren't paying 40% higher than the rest of the country, which is really what the minimum wage was raised to. So we went to the state and they gave us some help with our productivity. That's when we were introduced to lean manufacturing.
Ah, okay.
The state paid for a consultant to come in and transform our factory so that we were a lean, proficient in the basics of lean manufacturing, all sorts of different ways to improve our productivity. And what
Mitch,
that
is lean
did,
an acronym like LEED is in the architectural business, or
it's just keeping costs down
and stuff.
It's not really about keeping costs down. Most people who don't really dive into lean
uh-huh.
think that's what it's about.
Okay.
Lean is about making sure that all of your production is about adding value to the product, and you use better processes to eliminate anything that doesn't add value to the product. So an example of that is that when someone in my factory is actually putting two pieces of fabric together under a needle, they're sewing it, they're adding value to the product. But if they have to take any time sending goods to the next station or looking for a pair of scissors or waiting for their supervisor to get off the phone so they can ask a question,
yeah,
that's something that's not adding value to the product.
Okay.
So if we consistently eliminate those non-value added
right.
tasks, we can spend more of our time producing. So after our lean transformation, we had actually tripled our productivity in the hat factory. We were making three times as many hats with the same people. So even though we were paying more,
right.
our unit labor cost was going down. And then with stroke, we had a stroke of luck in 2006 when I'm sorry, 2006. It was
For the minimum wage changed, right?
Yeah, no, it was I think it was 2008.
Okay.
Oh no, it was 2006. 2006, the federal minimum wage changed.
Okay.
And when the federal minimum wage changed, the rest of the country was brought up to the level that New Jersey was at. Most of our competition had they just raised their prices,
right?
Because they, you know, they thought, oh, the rest of the country has to do it, and we're like, well, we figured out how to be competitive, paying 40% more than you.
Right.
What that did to us was that made us the low cost, even though we were a union shop right outside of New York City. We became the low cost option for anyone who wanted products made domestically.
Wow.
Up until that point, we were pretty much shut out of the military business. Because even though all military apparel needs to be made in USA, we couldn't touch Georgia.
Right,
because
it's still a request for proposal, right? You have to submit, there's laws that say, right.
To bid products. So when that happened, process, we started bidding on jobs. We figured out the business in a year. And within a year, we were getting jobs that we could never get before. So we started in headwear, and then in 2007, we bought a bag factory much the same way that we bought the hat factory, which was to buy the assets of a foreclosed on company, brought all that into Newark, brought most of their workers over and started making bags.
Now, were you in this in the location you are now? Or?
Yes, we moved to Newark in 2001.
Oh, aren't you already there. Now, can we go back for a second? How did you know, how did you get the state to come and pay for that? Well, let's call it an upgrade or a rework of your factory. How did you come across that, and how'd you get them to pay for it?
So there's an agency called New Jersey Manufacturers Extension Partnership, which it's funded by the Department of Labor, the Department of Commerce, I think it's funded by the Department of Commerce. They have their own funding sources.
Okay.
They get grant money from the Department of Labor. In any event, they had been calling on me, offering their services to help. And at around that time, I said, look, we're going to have trouble staying in New Jersey if we have to pay so much for labor. And they said, there are grants available to help you do this. They wrote a grant proposal for us and ended up getting a grant. We ended up getting grants from the state through NJMEP on and off for about 10 years. And I was so enamored of the organization that I'm now on their board. And I sit on their board, so I've been really affiliated with them for a long time, and that organization is fantastic. They've recently taken a very leading role in making sure that manufacturers in New Jersey are able to produce protective equipment for healthcare workers around the region. Anyway, back from that side.
Yeah, sorry, I was curious. Yeah, okay,
I think I actually remember where I left off. It was around 2007, 2008,
right?
And we were manufacturing bags for all the same, for unions and for political campaigns,
right?
But then 2008 came around, and the recession came around. The prices in America stagnated, wages stagnated here, and China became this juggernaut, and their wages were increasing by 30% per year, and all of a sudden, it was not that much more expensive. It was still more expensive, but not so much more expensive to have goods made in China.
It wasn't unaffordable.
Yeah, so to have goods made domestically above and beyond what you can get it made in China for.
Right.
So at that point, there were a lot of organizations that thought, well, you know, like NPR, for example.
Yeah.
NPR, while they're having all these stories on about sweatshops and things like that, they're buying bags made in China because it's so much less expensive. It's hard to justify a nonprofit to pay so much more money for something made in America. And it might have been 10 times more expensive in the early 2000s.
Right.
But by 2009, maybe it was 30% more expensive to get stuff made in America versus China.
Uh-huh.
At that point, we were able to convince a lot of nonprofits. The biggest category was domestic manufacturers.
Okay.
Particularly the automobile companies, the liquor and beer industry, and other companies that were marketing themselves as made in USA.
Right.
But a big proponent of marketing is promotional items.
Right.
So here they are, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on ad campaigns for made in USA products, and then they're giving away trinkets that say made in China on them with their logo on it. right. sending such a mixed message.
I know.
So,
but these were the companies, you know, not again, like the union. So the car companies, they have unions. You might be dealing with them separately. You're talking about the car company itself, like
yes,
they give away
the
items.
The automobile company,
right.
Or the dealerships.
Right, the dealerships.
The dealerships, for example, they give away a lot of items.
Right.
So we're like, okay, you've got this big poster in the window. It's made in USA. And then someone comes and you give them a product, and inside the product it says made in China.
Right.
What kind of message is that sending? You're not standing behind what you believe in. And it was a much easier sell when the premium for made in USA was much smaller.
Right.
So that really opened our market up. And God, that was already 12 years ago.
Yeah.
But for the last 10 years, we've had a much bigger market, and unions have become a much smaller part of our customer base. Now it's just as much, probably as much as anything, corporations. We do a lot of military contracts now.
Right.
This year, up until the time of coronavirus hit, we were almost 100% political campaign.
Sure, they're all buying from you.
Yeah.
I saw that LinkedIn thing you posted, yeah.
So, we really were able to broaden who we were selling to and the types and number of products that we were selling. And now we're more of a full service. Basically, we manufacture any woven accessory that someone can put their logo on for people who want to use that accessory to promote their willingness.
Right.
I'm going to say this again, to promote how dedicated they are to the American economy and the American worker.
Right. So that includes hats, bags, what else besides, like, you know?
Hats, bags, and then leather and vinyl portfolios and binders.
Oh,
that
okay.
you would give away at a convention or a meeting. That
right.
was a business I got in 2017 when we bought the assets of another company that had closed down and moved them into Newark and just started selling the same products to the markets we already sell to.
Got it. So those are like the ones with the logos like pressed in and things like that for conferences and stuff like that.
Yes.
Got it. And didn't you started working in the corporate promotions business with our friend Vic. Didn't you start something like that, or was that part of that?
Yes. Part? Yes, we did. We did start that. Victor is a publisher of Newark Bound Magazine, started a company called Diverse Promotions. He wanted to promote made in Newark products to the anchor businesses of and around the city of Newark.
Right.
There's a lot of major corporations that are located in the city of Newark that want to support local businesses. And so we did a joint venture together to promote Newark made products to these businesses. And it was very successful from the get-go.
Yeah. Well, Vic's well tied into Newark, and so were you. So
yeah,
it's a good, so, and you're not making all those products though, because some of them you can't make in your factory, right?
Correct. So we're making whatever we can make. We're sourcing whatever we can source locally, and then we're decorating everything locally.
Got it. But you're still sticking with the same thing: American, local, preferably in Newark, to support the local economy.
Yes.
And how many employees before the Corona thing? How many employees do you guys have in the factory?
So we had 180
okay.
before the Corona. Last time I checked, they're all still coming back to work when this is over. But right now, we can only get about 30 of them to come to work.
So do you have
we're
to pay them under
it.
Union rules?
What's that?
Do you have to pay them under union rules, or are they furloughed?
They're furloughed.
Okay.
So
you don't have to pay them because you don't have the
yeah,
money.
Yeah, we did it. We worked it out with the union,
right.
And they're furloughed. We offered people a furlough probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago already. And almost everybody took it.
Right.
And then when we started getting busy with the protection equipment, we couldn't get anybody to come back in here. I think because the unemployment benefits are really
right,
high. I think
up.
The reason that those unemployment benefits are high is so people won't want to come back to work, which I understand. I mean,
yeah.
And also we really want to be spread out. We could be, we're operating with 180. We only have 30 people in there
the same
now.
Building.
We probably have.
Yeah.
Yeah. We
yes.
probably have 60 people in there and still be really spread out. But one solution that we had was to find people who could work from home. And we were up to about 20 people working from home. They're picking goods up in the morning, dropping it off at night. And we're going to expand that part of the business over the next couple of weeks until we're comfortable bringing more people back.
Right. Things start to change. So all those people have sewing equipment at home so they can sew things. They can't embroider things, can they? Or are they just sewing these items?
they're just selling the items. Right, so unfortunately, none of these, and it's all protection equipment. That's the only thing that we're working on right now.
Yeah. So what are, when you say protection equipment, what are you guys making?
So we're manufacturing isolation gowns.
Okay.
And we're manufacturing face shields, clear vinyl or right. clear polycarbonate or clear PET face shields.
Right.
That are worn over a mask. We
right.
didn't
they,
get into
there's
the
like
mask
a headband, bit. Right? And then it drops down in front of your face like a welder, except it's clear.
Yes. So
right. I've seen that.
The, one of the reasons we jumped on that is everyone wanted us to get into, and I say everyone, our clients and people were asking us to make masks, but we couldn't make masks that could be used by hospital workers.
Yeah, they're not compliant, right? From a healthcare standpoint.
Yeah, there's if yeah. you put a needle through a piece of fabric, there's a hole there.
Yeah.
Bacteria, germs, viruses can get through. Yeah. That's why none of the N95 masks, none of the surgical masks have any sewing in them.
Right.
So we can't we had no advantage in making those masks, and we could sew something that civilians could use
right.
or that healthcare workers could use in the interim, but we couldn't sew them fast enough to make, especially if they're going to be disposable, to make a meaningful difference.
Right.
We wanted to make a meaningful difference. And face shields, as soon as someone sent me the picture of a face shield,
you're like, we can do this, right?
Yeah. I said, that's a headband from a baseball hat with the clear vinyl front of a binder sewn to it. We could do that.
Oh, right. You already have the plastic because it goes inside the hats, right? They clip on the back and then you make the face shields. Oh, okay. That makes
yeah.
sense.
And the only other piece is a piece of foam. And we have foam that we use in backpack straps. And in laptop bags.
Got it.
So we were sitting on, we counted, we got a picture from the New York Hospital Association one morning. They said, can you make these? And I looked and I said, not only can we make these, I can make a prototype right now and start production this afternoon. All we need is either sweatbands or elastic, foam, and clear vinyl. So we just went, we jumped right into it. It was very popular from the beginning. And it's something that is right. a more permanent item for a hospital worker. And it's actually compliant.
And it can be cleaned. You don't have to throw it out, right? Just spray it.
It can be cleaned. Yes. And then I worked with another manufacturer, it's really a contractor, a military contractor who subcontracts textile work to us.
Got it.
A company called Polymer Technologies. They produce, they do plastic injection molding and other types of injection molding. And they are able to mold a piece that made the vinyl removable and replaceable. So that's the next stage of what we're producing. We're going to start working on those in about 7 days. That's been exciting for us. And then the gown business is just
making
really
gowns,
strong
right?
products. Yeah. yeah, just making figuring out something that was cost effective that we could produce quickly and get into the hospitals as quickly as they needed them.
So are the raw materials, the supplies harder to come by like some of this other stuff or not really?
The raw materials have been an incredible challenge.
Yeah.
For us,
right.
and then convincing the hospitals that what they're looking for as far as testing and compliance is completely unavailable has been an incredible challenge as well, because the hospitals keep holding out for something that's been tested and approved.
Right,
they want us to get approved, and I'm looking and I see pictures on the news of nurses wearing garbage bags.
Right,
and I'm thinking, our stuff isn't approved, but
it's better than that.
It's better than a garbage bag.
Right.
So we've had success in doing that. We've had the hospital associations weigh in. We've had other politicians help weigh in and get FDA approvals waived just so we could use materials that were available.
Right.
But just like the hoarding of toilet paper, all of these PPE products, there's the hoarding of the raw materials. There's just not enough raw materials around
right.
to make this stuff. So we have to be creative with what we use.
Right.
And there's not enough raw materials because there's not a lot of manufacturing in the country.
Right.
So, textiles, fabric in general, there's hardly any sewing. I think 2% of the textile products that are worn in America are actually made in America, which means that 98% of the fabric is sitting outside of America.
Right.
Because why would you inventory the fabric in America if it's going to be sewn over in China or Mexico?
Yeah.
So all sorts of fabrics are wiped out. Fabric stores that are fabric storage that's done overseas can't get here.
Right.
Because there's not enough containers. All the containers are in America right now. They never went back out after the last couple of shipments came in here. So it's a mess. Fortunately, I've been in the business for almost 30 years, and I've got a lot of connections, and I'm able to find raw materials that we can use,
right.
able to find workarounds, and I'm able to help other people who are manufacturing things
yeah.
and need access to these raw materials.
Yeah, I interviewed a guy this morning who owns Fabricland out on Route 22. He's in one of my networking groups, and it's a third-generation business. You know, they can't make a lot of stuff that's compliant, so they're making kits for people to sew their own masks at home.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, he doesn't have the... You know, he sells raw goods, so he doesn't have seamstresses to sew this thing for people. But I would think we used to have a sewing machine. It broke recently, so even if I got the kit, I couldn't make masks for us. But I don't know. Maybe there's somebody out there who could do it.
There's such a shortage of sewers in this country
yeah.
that it's going to be very difficult to make masks for the whole country right now.
Right.
People haven't sewn in this country for a long time. There haven't been sewing jobs for a long time.
Right.
And
he said the same thing too. He deals with all of his manufacturers for a long time. They keep him first on the list, but he runs out of elastic. He runs out of whatever it is all the time.
And the sewing machines that we have in our factory, we can't put them in a house because any industrial sewing machine is going to run on 220 power. Nobody has 220 power in their house.
Right. Could you even move them? They're big machines, right? They're heavy.
No, we could move them. We just can't plug them in someone's house.
Right.
So we're trying to find more people who can sew from home
Have their own machines.
Yeah. We're also trying to design products so it limits the amount of sewing. Even if it means we have to spend more on raw materials, we'd rather... sewing is going to be a bottleneck for us.
Right, because it'll speed up the manufacturing process, what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't even want to mention what some of the raw material shortages are because I don't want to create a further shortage.
Exactly. Well, I'm hoping this will come out in 4, 5, 6 weeks. So I'm hoping by then things will change a little bit. We'll be out to the middle of May. I'm hoping by Mother's Day things start to loosen up a little bit and people are getting out and are allowed to get out.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I can't do anything.
Yeah.
But you're one of the few guys who are working. I mean, you got to go to the factory every day?
No, I'm not going during the day.
Okay.
We've got a whole system set up. I'm going at night.
Okay.
So I'm not encountering anybody.
Right.
No one is really having any face-to-face in the factory.
Okay.
And
they're all wearing masks and stuff?
They're all wearing masks. They're all wearing gowns.
Right. Do
you
have a process
where
there's a process that you have to use to clean the factory, or is it the same as it's always been?
No, it's definitely using a lot more
cleaning stuff,
disinfectant and cleaning supplies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem with this whole thing is that people can be asymptomatic. Like you can have people on the line and they're fine. You got no clue. And then, you get hit with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk about everything. I think it's timely given, not only your great story, because you've hosted some of my entrepreneur academies that I had in the past, and you were on The Prophet once, I think, right? So you're in the mix when it comes to environmental stuff. You still there, Mitch?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Yeah, it was some feedback or something. And I think it's timely now because there's a lot of stuff going on out there where people don't know really what to do, and they're not as good. I know you don't give yourself enough credit, but you're very good at not only being creative and figuring out how to make your business work and under the circumstances and dealing with change, but every successful business owner knows that everything's going to change, right? That's the one thing. Nothing's going to stay the same, but this is a drastic change. This isn't a gradual change. Where you can say, okay, I see this coming 18 months down the road. This is like boom, and congratulations to you. You handled it not only well for your employees and for the health of the people, but a way to help and to still keep your factory open.
Yeah. Well, I said right at the beginning to my employees, I said, just remember one thing, and this is before we thought it would be anywhere near as bad as it is now.
Right.
I said chaos is always good for us.
Yeah.
Because it's something that we handle really well. We will handle this better than a big company.
Yeah.
We will handle this better than someone who is not as nimble as us, which is virtually anybody in the sewing business in America.
Right.
And let's now start thinking about ways that we can pivot our business to make sure that we not only survive but can thrive through this and come out stronger than we were before.
Yeah.
And everyone bought into that message. And we've been working together, and we transformed that business so fast. I mean, think about going from a selling promotional hats and bags to, you know, for whimsical purposes, and then changing that and making life-saving equipment in 2 weeks.
Right.
And
having unheard of.
Yeah. And we're sitting on Slack and we're making up the rules all day long as we go along. I'll say, let's do this. Let's price it here. We need a product name. We need product shots. We need this.
Right.
Or inquiries are coming in faster than we can create the marketing materials for it.
Right.
We're running into supply shortages. So all of a sudden we have to change the color of it. We have to change the dimensions of it. We have to do this on the fly.
Yeah. It's like wartime. You got to deal with what you have.
Yeah. Yes. So.
But you look at like the stuff that's going on at the federal level, which is a shit show to begin with, and the Defense Production Act, which he can't manage anybody when it comes to life. How long do you think it's going to take General Motors to make a ventilator? They'll never get it done.
I don't know. My money is on some of these companies. There's a lot of really sharp talent at those companies, and they have really good systems to work together for product development. So it will take a while.
But they got to retool. There's a lot of parts. I mean, there should have been a team, people making different parts, different companies. And maybe there are different companies involved. I don't know. Maybe we don't hear about it.
I think a lot of these companies are – the big companies are very good at doing things like this. And I feel like there are entrepreneurs within companies.
Yeah.
And there are business people. And everyone is shocked into working differently than they did before.
Right.
And they're actually coming up with ideas much faster and much more open-minded to change because they have to be.
Right.
Because I'm seeing stuff that would have taken my company months getting done in a day.
Yeah.
Because of that. So I believe that ventilators will be produced, vaccines will be produced, testing kits will be produced way faster than it could have been done in normal circumstances.
Oh, no question about it. We'll probably have a vaccine in the fall or maybe early spring. It usually takes 5 to 7 years for a vaccine.
Right.
Clinical testing. But look, I think that makes me feel a little bit better that you feel that way. I guess it's true, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. So everybody's freaking out. Everybody's panicking. We're going to figure this out. I just wished we had a little bit better leadership at the front lines. You know, I mean, I see some of the governors that I'm impressed with the way they're handling themselves, you know, Cuomo and, you know, even Murphy. I'm not a huge fan of his, but he's handling himself. Connecticut, the woman in Michigan, some of them have been a shit show. But then the stuff that comes out of Washington, you know, the medical people are great. But the political leaders are just a wreck, and I don't think it gives a lot of people confidence. I mean, maybe you're more in the mix of the whole business community in Newark and the state and things like that, so it gives you more confidence. I don't know. I stopped watching this stuff. It's just too depressing.
Right.
Listen to the stupid stuff.
Yeah. I just think that politicians will set the tone.
Right.
But they're not. They're not going to drive the bus.
Obviously not. When the rubber meets the road, we're not going to church on the 12th. I mean, you know,
right?
Nobody thought that was serious.
We have to see what's going on, and we have to make decisions for ourselves. An example of that is the recommendation that everyone wears masks. What if it becomes a law?
Right.
Where will all the masks come from?
Right.
And then you think, okay, who's going to be able to buy a mask and who's going to have to be issued a mask because they can't afford one or don't have access or don't have a credit card or don't have internet access.
Right.
And then you think, okay, if people are going to be issued masks, maybe the government is going to buy them. Well, what are the shortages? Well, there's not enough sewing. So can we come up with a mask that doesn't involve sewing?
Right.
There's probably not enough elastic in the country to create all these masks. That was the one thing I didn't want to mention before, but now that you said it's 5 weeks away, it'll be too late by then. But yeah, there's definitely not enough elastic in the country to make masks for everyone.
Right, there's not.
So how do we make a mask without elastic?
Yeah.
And you start thinking of all of these things, and then you think, okay, if I can come up with a solution to those problems before the problem exists, I'll be the one who's ready to solve those problems. And I already have the ear of people in the right places because I've helped them out of jams during this crisis already.
Right.
And we'll be able to supply or at least point them in the right direction.
Yeah.
Of this is how you get this done.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the masks, can't they tie behind your head? Especially the cloth ones for individuals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So
can you wash them? Forget about the medical facilities. For people. Right.
For people, yes, you want something that's washable, so you don't have to keep replacing them.
Right.
And the face shield's also a great solution because The cloth shields don't have any moisture barrier, but if you wear it in conjunction with a clear vinyl or a plastic face shield, then you've got the moisture protection as well. Right. And you've got the eye protection. So
People sneezing on you or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends who's, you know, their husband's a police officer, a fireman, or they work at a hospital. They said it's like a war zone. It's so much worse. I mean, obviously their perspective is much different than what we're dealing with. Maybe your perspective is different than mine, but he said you can't imagine the amount of death that they're seeing and the amount of, you know, the bodies and the sickness and the people all over the place, and it's just craziness. You know, it's not something that I don't know if I can deal with it. A lot of these guys are going through PTSD again because of all the terrible stuff they're seeing. So
sure.
But like you said, the sun will rise another day. We'll get through it like we get through everything. And I'm not discounting the people that are going to die and have died. That's terrible. But I guess if we didn't jump and do all the things, it would tend to be tens of thousands and be hundreds of thousands, you know?
Yeah. Well, I hope out of this we don't forget what the cost of outsourcing our manufacturing industry to another country is.
Oh, I think there's a new normal. I think people are going to rethink their global supply chains and know that not only are they don't want to be reliant on other countries for raw goods, but, you know, this got here because we live in a global world, right? I mean, everybody's traveling around and things are going around and goods are coming shipped in. And, yeah, look, maybe it'll help the Made in America industry.
Yeah, it definitely will help the Made in America industry.
Right.
I expect there to be some legislation along the lines of what I mentioned before about the military being required to buy uniforms. That requirement is because it's stated right there in the law. They have to keep certain industries alive so they're there in times of war.
Right.
The military uniforms are not made in USA.
They're not?
I'm saying they are made in USA, but they're not for any security purposes.
Right.
There's nothing special where we don't want technology to fall in the hands of the enemy with a uniform.
Right.
The whole reason uniforms are made here is because if we're shut off from our supply lines, at least we have a source of supply for uniforms here. I believe that the federal government should enact some sort of legislation or public policy that any publicly funded healthcare institution has to have their products made in USA for the same purpose. So this doesn't happen again because we are at war right now.
Yeah, there's no question about it. All right, Mitch, so listen, take care of you.
If you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at beinlaw33@gmail.com. That's beinlaw33@gmail.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur has been written, directed, and produced by Mitchell Beinacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.